The Athletic.
Hello there. Thanks for tuning in this week to the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. It is our penultimate episode of 2023. I'm Ali Maxwell with three wise men. Well, I'm here with three men. Michael Cox, Liam Tharm, and Mark Carey. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Wow. Hi.
Shout out to Gavin B for the idea behind this week's topic. Almost every week, I put a call out to the listeners. I say, tweet us. I say, comment on the episode page. On the Athletic app, we'd love to hear your ideas for future episodes. And it's not an empty request. It's not engagement for engagement's sake. Sometimes the wind turbines of our minds need a little backup generator for ideas. And that's what we got this week. But Gavin's idea is this. Prior to the 2000s, there seemed to be a clear formula to chasing a game. For the last 5 minutes, put your centre back up and go long. Nowadays, the way teams chase games is much more varied. What are the options for how to chase a game? Which options are best? And how much risk should you be willing to take as the clock ticks down? It's perfect for us. It's really interesting. So let's chop it up. Michael, kick us off here. What are the options when you're down and you're chasing a game?
Well, I'm interested in his timeline or his chronology, because I think that still happens quite a lot. I think that was the default much later than the 2000s as well, even for quite technical players. I mean, I remember that famous 2009 Champions League semi-final between Barcelona and Inter, Barcelona putting Gerard Piqué up front late on after they'd taken off Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And Piqué scored a wonderful goal where he kind of spun two players in the six-yard box and finished. So I think it's a really good topic, but I still think putting a centre-back up is quite a big part of it.
I wonder if there's a growing trend now of central defenders being more about being ball players and not really being the aerially dominant players, or that style. It's a big coaching aspect of this, right? If it's not always just going to be about the player and the personnel, but I imagine there's certain coaches that just really despise that idea of the chaos and the control that you lose. And you then also get into the situation where the similar thing is the optimal thing of the really chasing the game is like the final corner when you send the goalkeeper up, and certain coaches seem to never do it, even if it's like it's final kick of the game. Do you just not want them there because they're just not that great a finisher? And then you go, okay, what's the purpose of them being there? Is it to, you know, try and cause chaos? Is it to have another defender that's then marking them to hopefully free up someone elsewhere? And I guess, yeah, it's just what players do you want in what positions? So it's a great spectacle to watch, but I see the tactical sort of conundrum it throws up.
We often talk about most of the elite managers being obsessed with control, and a lot of them are, whether it's possession-based or otherwise, quite dogmatic in the way that they approach the game tactically. Michael, is there an extent to which maybe the modern manager feels more so than in previous generations that chucking up a centre-back is almost like admitting defeat? Their game plan wasn't good enough, isn't working, and they almost don't want to admit that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe there is part of that involved. I'd like to give a shout out to the Lionesses and Millie Bright in particular, because she's become such a specialist at this. She's a centre-back, of course, and she's become such a specialist at being a plan B up front that when she went out injured, there was almost more chat about who's going to be England's plan B as much as who's going to play in central defence instead of her, because England had worked on it. They'd practised it in friendly tournaments, and in the Euros last year against Spain, it worked to great effect. There's still a big case for doing that. At the same time, I think a lot of traditional centre-forwards are now almost regarded as purely plan Bs. I mean, if you've got a player in your team that's purely good in the air, a proper target man, they're not usually going to be playing for the top clubs. Even the kind of sides battling relegation, you don't see that many type of those players. I mean, even someone like, off the top of my head, Kiefer Moore down at Bournemouth. You know, maybe 10 years ago, a player like that would be a starting number nine in the Premier League. But even he's regarded as a plan B for a side like Bournemouth. I know Bournemouth are playing quite technical football. I mean, especially with 5 subs available and 9 on the bench now, teams often do have that kind of player in reserve to bring on for the last 20 minutes or so.
I think you make a good point, Ali, about the sort of the tactical intelligence of managers nowadays. And that's not to say that they weren't intelligent before and they were just randomly throwing centre-backs at the sort of at the death of the game. But I think it's now more on the onus is on the managers to identify where there are weaknesses in the opposition, and rather than it just be a centre-back kind of your most obvious change, it to be like, well, potentially there's maybe overloads to be had in the wide areas. We've got a weakness in the opposition fullback and we can overload, we can double up against them and maybe get into wide areas and cross from there or cut back or whatever it is.
I think you've also got to look at the perspective, and whenever you start doing it in the game, well, what then happens if that succeeds and that works? And there's a great example at the World Cup where it was Netherlands against Argentina, where Netherlands were 2-0 down, brought on Weghorst and Luke de Jong off the bench, which were two very much two big guys, two guys to cross it to. And they then recovered it to 2-0 and went into extra time. And I remember watching it in the office and saying, well, how on earth do they attack now? I'm like, you've got to play 30 minutes where you've got two players that you'd brought on with the intention of doing just this, but you know, for the style that they'd played when I watched them in the Nations League and in the build up to the World Cup, of trying to play this quite stylish back three, lots of creative midfielders and really sort of advancing wing backs, I'm like, you now almost have to prepare for, okay, well, if this works and we get what we want, do we go back to plan A? Is there a plan C, et cetera, et cetera? It's I guess it's as much about avoiding the panic that can then sort of ensue from that, because it feels like quite a reactive strategy. And I wonder, as a defending team, if someone does it against you, do you think, well, this is it, they've got nothing else left? It's, you know, if they then start shooting from distance, you go, they're running out of ideas. That it's probably the hardest thing to defend against, but it can become the most predictable, I think, because you go, okay, we know we're just going to face balls into the box now. If we've got a keeper that can come and claim stuff, defenders that can clear it, every single time we get it away, we go, okay, that's another win.
And I think that's the good thing about just doing it with a centre-back. Centre-back can go back to defence again without wanting to labour the Millie Bright point. That was exactly what happened against Spain in the Euros last year. Went up front for 10 minutes, helped get the equaliser, and then just went back, and England shifted back to a back four. So that's the value of it. If there's extra time, obviously that's, you know, if it's a 90-minute game, it's not really going to be an issue, but extra time, absolutely.
Mark, we're in an era where so many different and precise aspects of the game have had like scientific studies done on them, and I wonder if it's possible, or whether it has been done, to run the numbers on the decision to go long, so to speak, whether it's with a centre back or with a, I always think of Fernando Llorente when I think of the sort of plan B big striker, versus continuing with plan A, making plan A better, whether that be a more, you know, continuing with a more patient build-up approach to try and work openings, even if it seems a little slower to do so. I mean, I presented the idea just now that it's some sort of personal reason. Managers don't want to look like their tactical plan has failed. But there's every chance, and probably more likely, that they've crunched the numbers and it's been worked out that that's actually maybe not the smart play.
Yeah, I haven't seen any kind of academic studies or research to kind of do this, but I think, again, it speaks to the strength and the tactical discipline of the manager to, as we say, plan B almost sounds kind of defeatist, but it's not so much going to plan B other than having a tactical playbook that you can call upon depending on the different scenarios. And I think I'd certainly be naive to assume that they don't already do that. So maybe they'd roll the ball onto the pitch during training and say, okay, you're playing a 4-3-3. You're losing 2-1, you've got 10 minutes to go. How can we approach this game? How can we do these sorts of things? So yes, I'm sure they have probably crunched the numbers, but they've also done their due diligence in the modern game to be able to ensure that the team is prepared for it and it's less kind of instinctive on the fly, and it's a no stone unturned in a similar way to ensure that you can get the outcome that you want knowing you've prepared for it, I suppose.
Yeah, I think building on our penalties pod as well, in that when we speak about the psychological aspect of that, this is something you can try and train, but then there is a difference between being on a training ground on a Tuesday afternoon where there's not loads of fans around. Like you can't perfectly recreate it. There's that great clip of Arteta before Arsenal goes to Anfield where he plays the You'll Never Walk Alone music, and that's trying to find a way, but it's a really imperfect thing to try and train. And I guess it's the footballing equivalent to, I guess, the Hail Mary in NFL, right? That you're saying, okay, if this comes off, because theoretically then people say, why don't you just play this way the whole game if this is what you do when you really need to score? But it's like, you keep doing this, and if it works and it comes off, then, you know, you're almost guaranteed to score. But every time it doesn't, well, then that becomes a big problem because you're turning over the ball all the time. And the Newcastle game last night against Milan comes to mind, and I know that this is a great example because they were chasing a game even though they were drawing because they needed the win, but they had a couple of instances where they just don't defend the transition very well. Their rest defence looks a bit too wide, a bit too stretched. So by rest defence we mean where the players are stood, defenders specifically, when the team's in attack, so where they're positioned to try and then pounce on to, you know, defend loose balls, defend counter-attacks. And maybe they get to the ball first and then they miss-kick the clearance or they don't recycle the ball well. Rafa Leao gets in one-on-one and hits the post with a good chance. And then there's a similar transition. The Leao chance comes from, I think, a cross that gets cleared away. And then there's a situation where Fabian Scher actually goes on the overlap and he's out of position. And Ali McCoy's in commentary actually, as it's going on, goes, oh no, Scher's out of position here. And they break and they end up scoring. So it's being prepared to, I think, lose the game in trying to win it. And there's, I guess, some coaches that just aren't prepared to do that at certain times.
I also think going back to the original point of having your centre back go into the box and just kind of getting crosses or playing long balls is actually the least optimal. The Scher one was actually interesting from the Newcastle game because he was trying to commit and run off the ball and on the ball to sort of get bodies into a typical sequence of play to try and work the ball into a more lucrative area rather than a fast track into the box where typically it's a congested area where nearly 22 players are in one third of the pitch, where it's suboptimal to do it that way and be so direct. I'd argue that if it's like that, you need to get the ball more into wide areas and get crosses in. There are so many different ways to kind of go for that Hail Mary, and I think that to just assume it's the centre back just getting on the end of crosses isn't so good. I think, as Liam said, it's more being prepared to leave gaps behind you, whether that's midfield runners just like maybe camping out in the box a little bit more, knowing that there's a risk-taking element here. And then, as you say, they might get caught on the break, as Newcastle did last night.
Still running, Scher. Good defending by Calabria.
He's out of possession.
Here come Milan. Jovic. Played on here. A goal! It's Chukwueze off the bench. Super sub for Milan. Brilliant finish into the top corner. And it could be a heartbreaker in Europe for Newcastle.
Michael, how did we get to the point where the phrase Plan B conjures up such a specific image of putting a tall player, centre-back or sub-striker in the middle and putting in more crosses into the box? You know, I think of Fernando Llorente as an example, but why does it need to mean that? When did that happen?
Is this Spurs era Llorente you're thinking about? Yeah. Because he also did it for Spain in 2010. Interesting. Against Portugal, I think.
Well, I was going to ask if this is a specifically British thing, whether in continental Europe and the specifics of each nation having their own identity, do they also put a big striker up top and swing in crosses historically?
That is a good question, actually. I guess they do.
I remember doing a piece on this a couple of years ago where Barcelona, you mentioned Pique before, Barcelona were doing it quite a lot and Stoke were playing some fantastic football at that time. And I remember the piece being, have Stoke become Barcelona and Barcelona become Stoke? Right. So I think it's not uncommon for it to happen on the continent.
It's funny you bring up Stoke and Barcelona because I was talking to someone the other day. I think they were talking about Sheffield Wednesday. Their new manager is quite often playing four natural centre-backs. And he said, Pep-esque, playing of four centre-backs. And I said, it's only 3 years since that was considered Tony Pulis's thing, was playing as many centre-backs as you could, and now it's considered a Pep Guardiola thing. Fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, on the Plan B thing, I guess that's Plan B in terms of an overall strategy rather than individual kind of combinations of players. Because really, if we talk about a centre-back or a backup striker coming on for the last 15 minutes, it's probably like Plan D at highest. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've probably used substitutes before that point. You might change system. So, yeah, there's a long way you have to go these days before you get to just playing, you know, longer balls and putting a really aerially dominant player up there. But what I think teams have got better at these days is, I feel like maybe 20 years ago, if you brought on that kind of player, you just play balls like from your centre-back, just like hoof forward towards the box. And they never work. Like defenders, if you're, you know, if you got probably five, you know, teams always revert to like a back five, often five good players in the air. You're never going to be troubled by that. But if teams get the ball out wide and then put crosses in, I think that's going to cause a lot more problems. And it kind of goes back to what Liam said about, well, why don't you play that way at the start? I mean, crossing the ball from wide is a perfectly legitimate tactic. Hoofing it from centre-back towards centre-forward, it doesn't really work, does it? So I think teams have become a bit more intelligent with how they do that. Plan B or Plan E or Plan F or whatever.
And that all feeds into the sheer volume of opposition analysis now, is that's what part of it is for. It's not just like, we want to know what this team does on a basic level. It will be, okay, if they're going 1-0 up, 2-0 up, 1-0 down, 2-0 down, etc. That, you know, you hear the manager say in press conferences, we've prepared for every sort of situation. And that will be what that work is of. It's weird because you want to prepare for it, but you don't really ever want to actually have to use the plan, because you want to be in control and in a position where that's okay. So yeah, I think it can be hard to notice a lot, but subs will definitely come after you've already tried to make tweaks, whether that will be system or at times switching players around, even more minute stuff here in terms of how you build up and your approach there. I think you even get it at set pieces where you might try something different on the third or fourth set piece. That's subs have to be way down the list.
I was going to say as well, it's an obvious point to make, but it is worth noting that you do have more opportunity and more time to be able to do plan B, C and D, for example, because of the sheer volume of time that's been sort of added on. With Nick Miller did a piece on this fairly recently, and the average amount of added time per game, so the first and the second half combined, mostly hovered somewhere between 6 minutes and 7 minutes, 6.5, let's say, for the 10 seasons before this one. And last season, it was closer to 8 minutes, so it was on the increase. And this season, and this is slightly outdated data, but it's in double figures, it's about 11 minutes. So even that, when you're thinking about chasing the game, a couple of minutes is quite crucial to be added on, to maybe just try something different and then maybe go for the Hail Mary, really go for broke if you really want to just lump it into the box. There's so much more opportunity. And I think you're kind of seeing it in the demeanor of the players, maybe not so much the manager, the demeanor of the players to actually still continue to play football when it's the 89th minute, because in theory they've still got about 11 minutes to go, rather than you start to normally see a bit of panic of you know, playing it a little bit longer. It's quite clear that this is starting to change now.
Yeah. All I was going to add was, we speak about now like the role of analysis in shaping this. I could be wrong, but from some of the reading that I've done, a lot of the reason for a lot of the direct play in sort of the very late 90s, particularly in English football in the early 2000s, is rooted in Charles Reap and Charles Hughes, right? And the research that was done there, the early sort of data analysis and, you know, findings that more goals are scored from sort of playing direct and playing long, accessing those positions of maximum opportunity. So they were doing what they thought was right at the time, and the managers are now. And we could probably have this discussion in 5-10 years time where they're doing even more different things and the rules look even more different now, because there'll be more, you hope, more in-depth and more nuanced sort of data analysis that finds even more ways of playing effectively.
Let's try and drill down and pick out some specifics here. I mean, Michael, are there any incidences other than that Barcelona PK performance of teams doing something innovative or interesting or notably effective when chasing a game?
One that stands out is Chelsea PSG in 2014, when Chelsea were managed by Jose Mourinho. And they ended up playing with three out-and-out strikers, Eto'o, Bar, who eventually got the win, and Fernando Torres. And it just struck me as really effective, because I think a lot of the time when teams end up with three strikers, they just get in each other's way. Like, there's just too many players in the box. I remember Arsenal, when they were trailing in European competitions, always used to bring in Kanu as an extra centre forward, and he just like wasn't suited to it. He got in other players' way. Everything became about just playing long balls to him. And this, I mean, Chelsea played in this game, I think in the end it was almost a front four with Schürrle on the left. It was just really effective. Clearly Mourinho, well, I think the players said afterwards, they'd worked on it on training. They'd worked on, you know, 80 minutes they did that, 85 minutes they were going to do that. They had a very precise plan. And one of the subs, Demba Ba, came up with the winning goal. So I think managers have just, they have got more of a game plan. They have got more options. They know precisely what they're going to do. I don't think they're thinking on their feet. And they're not just shoving on an extra striker and saying, go on, play up front. The formation around them adjusts. And I know that sounds an obvious thing, but I think if you go back 20, 25 years, it was a little bit random and a little bit chaotic.
I always like to go into the Athletic archives for when we're doing a podcast and see what we've maybe written about it already. And I found one called The Premier League's Greatest Tactical Substitutions. So I thought, this is perfect. Do you know the writer, the author of this piece?
Yeah, it was me.
It was you?
Yeah.
It was you?
This was one of the reader's requests thing.
Was it? Yeah. Can you remember the games that you referred to?
People are demanding this analysis. Gavin, readers of the site.
Was this another Gavin B?
Is this what the people
come back
want?
A few years later.
Doesn't specify.
It was Villa Arsenal in 98 was one of
Brilliant
them.
Brilliant shout, yes.
I can't remember the others.
It was Spurs against Arsenal. Harry Redknapp bringing on Jermaine Defoe for Aaron Lennon.
You know what? I did just think that. And then I got confused with another memory, which is... sitting next to Harry Redknapp at a dinner once and mentioning that game to him, and he had no recollection of it at all. So I couldn't remember whether that was before or after that.
That's incredible.
That article.
Well, there's that one, and Roberto Mancini bringing on Nigel de Jong for Sami Nasri when City beat Newcastle 2-0.
So that was a good one, because they were 0-0. He brought on a holding midfielder, de Jong, for Nasri, a playmaker, but then pushed Yaya Toure forward, which was his... That was his plan B. So that's quite a good example of an obvious plan B that wasn't just, you know, playing long balls. And of course, Toure scored two crucial goals.
What are Liverpool doing so well on this front? They stand out in terms of their record coming from behind. This season, they've been behind 10 times already. Quite a lot, I would say, for a team expected to win almost every game. They've equalised 9 times out of 10, obviously losing just the once. That's the best record this season. But last year as well, Mark, Newcastle, Arsenal and Liverpool had the best equalising rate, that the highest percentage of games successfully chased, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, I mean, the Liverpool example, certainly this season, I think probably worth noting that quite a few of those have been kind of early on. So when they've equalised or taken the lead, it's been they've had a lot of opportunities to do so. And it speaks to the point that I said before of against the, well, four more of the elite teams against the weaker teams, they have... You almost don't want to wake up the beast, and the earlier you maybe score against them, the more they sort of kick into gear a little bit. I think the Liverpool one's interesting in terms of their approach. I mentioned before about the, in my mind, the optimal way against a team who's maybe gone ahead and maybe sitting in more of a deeper block. For Liverpool, I think one of their key challenges has been actually getting the ball wide. What was previously their strength, they don't get wide quite as much now. Their volume of crosses in open play has gone down dramatically for reasons that we've spoken about already with Trent Alexander-Arnold playing more narrow. But I looked into the numbers, and I looked at how often they crossed the ball in open play per 100 touches when they were winning and when they were losing. So when they were in a winning game state, they crossed the ball just 0.8 times per 100 touches. When they were behind, that number leaps up to 2 times per 100 touches. So more than double when we're talking about the inclination to get it wide and cross. So I think, well, the example being most recently against Crystal Palace, their equaliser, granted, against 10 men, was to get the ball into an overload on the right-hand side, cross it, and then they sort of picked up something of a second ball, and it was a deflected finish. But it shows that obviously when you're chasing the game, we said about rather than those sort of vertical balls from sort of back to front to get the ball into wide areas, and there's more of an inclination for a side to cross the ball and obviously equalise or go ahead.
See, I think this is really interesting because we focused a lot on the target in the middle, whether it's a tall striker or a centre back. But how about having Trent Alexander-Arnold? You know, if you're going to resort to crossing or make that your plan B, C, D. Well, what a difference it makes to have the best crosser in the world providing the service rather than playing long straight balls or having fullbacks who aren't as natural in terms of delivering, doing that.
And it makes complete sense to go around the block if you're going to be playing against a deep block when you're chasing the game, then go directly through it, because that's arguably the most optimal way to try and equalise.
It's where the space is or isn't, right? And yeah, when teams start to compact that central area. So the one golden thread I'd really say in terms of player profiles that runs through Newcastle, Arsenal, Liverpool, looking back to last season, is their wingers or their wide midfielders. They've all got players that play inverted, so on the opposite side to their dominant foot, that can go 1v1, can go on the outside, can shoot from distance. Because at times, I think back to, was it Saka in the game against Manchester United, where as good as you can be tactically, sometimes you need a player to smash one in from 20 yards to open the game up a bit again. It's not always the prettiest goals that you score, and it's been the same for Liverpool when, you know, they've done a lot of that this season, actually, you know, not only coming back, but doing it with a man down. And we've done a whole podcast on that, so people can listen to that. But yeah, I think it's having that quality sometimes, make the space and cause problems. So I think having those players can really end up splitting games open sometimes.
And it could potentially drag the centre-back across. If you're creating an overload in a wide area and it's a two-on-one in the full-back, then the centre-back's got to come across, then everyone's got to shuffle over, then you create space elsewhere, as I say, rather than just the game being in front of all of the back four, back five, whatever, by playing more deeper balls into the box and crossing from less lucrative areas, should we say.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
Elliott's open up from here. Elliott puts it in the back of the net. Harvey Elliott for Liverpool. Are they on their way to the top of the table?
So it's become clear that you can change your tactics, or you can decide not to do that. But what else can you change? Well, personnel. And these days, you can change more of your team than ever before, half of your outfield players if you so wish. Let's talk about substitutes, or Michael, finishers, game changers. You sometimes can be a bit of a Scrooge about things like new phrasing for stuff. Where do you stand on substitutes being renamed finishers?
Well, he just said inverted wingers. I famously invented that. I mean,
yeah, and holding the ball and then giving it to your teammate at the last minute to take the penalty. You invented that too.
Well,
that needs a shorter name. It's a bit too long.
Dug it up from the archives. No, I mean, finishers mean something different, doesn't it? If you say he's a really good finisher, that means he's really good at scoring chances. So I just, you know, if we want a phrase for, I don't know, Edin Dzeko or Javier Hernandez going back a few years as a great plan B, I just don't think he's a great finisher. That can mean two different things.
Would be a better one. Game ender.
It obviously just contrasts nicely from starter and finisher, doesn't it? It's, I guess, why it's... Right. But it does become possibly problematic as terminology because people can easily confuse it. So
I don't think there's footballers getting confused what their manager means when he says, we need you to be a real finisher for us today.
The easy way to do it is to come off the bench and score loads of goals, and then just you mean both things, don't you? So you could... I think the word itself isn't the principal point, really, is it? It's the acceptance of the open-mindedness to
feel.
Say...
motivated, what's rather wrong, than like you've been chucked on the bench and jettisoned.
What's wrong with super sub? That's a lovely thing.
Yeah, there's...
Yeah, but they can't all... But you can't have five super subs, otherwise it loses its then meaning no one's, instantly. Yeah.
I guess it's more the principle of, like, it's not what the word means. It's about saying, okay, we're open-minded to the point that you can have a really significant and important role where you come on and you impact games. It's kind of like another American football example. It's like the kicker, right, that comes on, or the special teams that come on, and your role isn't to play 90 minutes, it's to come on and have a specific impact. So I guess, yeah, it's call it what you want. I guess it doesn't really matter. It's being open-minded to having players that can play a very specific, albeit shortened role.
Game changer, I don't mind that.
I'm tempted to say let's all be grown-ups and just call them substitutes. But I'm also less flippantly and facetiously aware, Mark, that this is probably one consequence of the increased analysis in the game and over the last 10, 15 years, trying to do things a little differently, trying to do things better. This is more about messaging to your players, and it's more of a probably motivational thing than anything else.
Yeah, and it's a psychological thing. I think that there's been a greater appreciation of psychology within sport more broadly and football more specifically in recent years. It obviously speaks to my background, so I'm really interested in that side of things. But also, that no stone unturned approach of learning from different sports. And, you know, Liam, you mentioned American football. I think that the finisher phrase has been taken from Eddie Jones talking about it a lot in rugby. So I know that might be to Michael's dismay, but I think that it's learning from different sports, different disciplines. I know that Gareth Southgate's gone to train, hasn't he got the England squad to train with the army in the past? And just, you know what I mean, learning about the sort of the impact of different backgrounds and how you can actually do that. I know that Jurgen Klopp has worked with in pre-season training someone who was I think an underwater diver, and how long you can push your body to the limit, all these different things to instill more kind of psychological confidence, more robustness and more resilience.
And it's not just about using psychology to improve a player's performance, Mark, but there's a lot of science and analysis that goes into things like substitutions and how to get the best out of them.
Yeah, and I looked into, as I always like to look at the, you know, previous research that's been done, more kind of at the physical level. I think I looked at something that was done by a lab in Spain, yeah, rather than the Spanish lads, looking at behaviours of teams. It was from the 2019-20 season where they had just three substitutions, and the 2020-21 season where they had the five substitutions for the first time in La Liga. And basically, total running distance was similar across both of those seasons, but the running distance at higher speeds were more prevalent in the five substitution season. So it speaks to Liam's point before, that it shows that the pace of the game is able to be kind of sustained for longer with this new format now that we've got five substitutions. And I guess that can be positive from an attacking and a defensive perspective, because you can have more concentration in both sides, and then it's still kind of whoever has the stronger resilience comes out on top. But the game is faster for longer, and obviously as a consequence, we're having more entertainment.
Always love the work those muchachos are doing to help us understand the game a little bit better. Michael, when it comes to subs and using subs, the thing that I always find most interesting is this battle, if you like, between, on the one side, fresh legs being needed, players who are not fatigued, who maybe will be up against an opposite man who is fatigued, and therefore you get the benefit of that, versus what you often hear as well, which is a lot of changes can actually disrupt the flow of the game and coherence can be affected in a negative way rather than getting the positives of an injection of fresh legs and high performance. I mean, is there really an answer to that discussion, or is that just one that will always go on?
Well, what I think is interesting is that managers are almost incentivized to use more subs than they need because they've only got a certain number of windows to make them. So you don't want to make three subs at three separate windows because then you feel like you're missing out. Mm. So I think managers tend to make double subs, even if maybe if they don't really want to, just because you feel you have to. And of course, if there's players who are just sitting on the bench for the 90 minutes who don't get on, they start to get aggrieved. So yeah, it is quite a tricky balance. I kind of agree with maybe what you're implying, which is that teams become a bit disorganized and things become a bit chaotic when you change so many players. I mean, people used to hate those international friendlies when teams could change, you know, the whole team. We're halfway there in normal league games with five subs now, which feels quite weird to me.
There was a great example going back to the World Cup again, Spain against Germany, where they both started with a quote-unquote sort of false nine or not a box presence. So Spain had Asensio as a false nine in there, their 4-3-3. Germany had Müller up top in their 4-2-3-1. Both brought on one of the quote-unquote big lads. So Spain brought on Alvaro Morata early into the second half. Germany brought on Füllkrug later on, and both players scored after coming on. But it became a second half where it gone from being very cagey, quite attritional, and very balanced, not really many chances, to a game that just completely opened up because both teams then suddenly couldn't really hold the ball very well. They had presences going forward, but there wasn't as much sort of sustained possession because they weren't having that midfielder drop in and making those overloads and being neat and connecting the play. It's as much about what you're prepared to lose and give up as what you want to have. And I guess there's just, as we've said before, like there's certain coaches that just don't want to lose control of the game in that way.
And one truism that is still, as far as I can tell, broadly true is that managers are loath to change their defenders compared to midfielders and attacking players. Let's look at the most used subs in the Premier League this season. And I think it's a really nice split because Harvey Elliott, Pierre Højbjerg, Yuri Tielemans have all been brought on 12 times, Jacob Brunn-Larsen 11, and then 10 times Adebayo of Luton, João Pedro, Sascha Kalajdzic, Jean-Philippe Mateta, Oliver Skip and Chris Wood. So there you have four meaty strikers, right? Adebayo, Kalajdzic, Mateta and Chris Wood. You've got three midfielders who at their best bring control, so Højbjerg, Skip, Tielemans. And then you've got a couple in Elliott and Larsen of attacking midfield, sort of wide types that you hope might provide a bit of extra quality in the half spaces in particular. It's a nice spread, but no defenders to be seen.
No, you very rarely get that. I can think of one example, going back to similar to what Mike was mentioning about with Manchester City before, that Graham Potter away to West Ham when he was Brighton head coach made a switch where they were 3-1 down in the second half, and he brought on wing backs and changed to I think a 3-4-3 from a 4-2-3-1 or something, and ended up getting back into the game, and the equaliser came from a cross from out wide from a midfielder putting wide. So yeah, you very rarely get that, and I guess I wonder if that's because by the time it comes to bringing on your forwards or your strikers, it's a case of, well, we've tried the tactical plan B and plan C, we've tried the shape change, or we've tried moving these players and attacking differently, and it's now okay, we've kind of got to resort to this a little bit.
We've had big contributions from Trossard, from Leon Bailey, Harvey Elliott, of course, last weekend. João Pedro stands out. He has scored 4 goals off the bench this season. I think a couple of them penalties. Interestingly, when we look at managers and trends, we have at extreme ends Pep Guardiola and Roberto De Zerbi, which is quite nice. So Pep, only 3 teams have made fewer changes this season than Man City, and City's subs get the fewest minutes on the pitch on average. Has he always been someone that's not that fussed about switching up his team?
I don't know if always, but certainly at City, it's often been a pattern. He's rarely used them. I mean, originally the 5 subs thing came in for COVID, and then the Premier League went back to 3 subs. and Guardiola complained quite a lot about that, but ironically, maybe, was the manager who used the fewest amount of subs and often went through a game and didn't use any at all. So yeah, he has been quite cautious with his use of changes.
Yeah, I looked into it across the previous four seasons, and City have made either the fewest or the second fewest subs per game on average in the Premier League. So yeah, it does speak to that. I think it's been most interesting or salient when they have been needing to chase the game or at least score a goal, and he still hasn't done it. He's kind of doubled down because I guess he's trusting his players and asking them to fulfill, almost out of anger, you set out to fulfill this game plan, go out there and do it. I shouldn't have to be changing things for you. Yeah. Well, that's at least the impression that I've got. But one of the memorable ones was last season. Of course, they won the Champions League, but against RB Leipzig, and I think it was the first leg, and there was still time to obviously come back into it. But I think people were querying why he didn't make a single substitution when they drew 1-1 away at Leipzig. And I remember one a couple of seasons ago now against Crystal Palace, and it was a 0-0 draw. And again, people were lamenting him for not making any substitutions. And he just chose to double down and just say that was the team that I asked to go and fulfill that game plan, and it's up to them to do it. So I don't know if it's just a Guardiola sort of way of being stubborn sometimes to make sure that he sort of lets the players know that. We know he often changes between games rather than within. But yeah, in stark contrast to Roberto De Zerbi.
De Zerbi's obsessed with substitutions, Liam. They make 4.75 changes a game, and their average substitute plays 25 minutes, the longest on average of any team in the league.
Some of that has been injury-induced. I think there's been knocks of players have picked up in games, particularly forwards. But he's also made a few half-time changes as well, I think at times double subs. Again, in part because Brighton have, I think, gone 1-0 down or conceded first a lot more this season than what they did last season. They had a better habit of scoring first or going ahead earlier in games. So I think he's then found a case of, okay, they have just been chasing a game more. And I guess his way of adapting that, responding to that in the way that he wants to play is adding on another forward. At times he'll often do like-for-like swaps. I think the best way that he's actually made changes this season was away to Marseille, where they were 2-0 down, I think about half an hour into the game or 20 minutes into the game. And the first thing he did really was actually tweak the tactics. He went from his sort of narrow sort of 4-4-2, if you like, where he's got the number 9 sort of coming off and playing alongside the 10. And he went to a 4-3-3 because they were getting man-marked on the last line, and stuff was going into the two strikers and things just weren't sticking. So he went to a single pivot and then brought on Billy Gilmore because he's the best player they've got to play in that role specifically. And suddenly they could then get two number 8s to make a front 5, and it was front 5 against the back 4. Couldn't man-mark as well, and they did better in
you know
the final
the rest.
Third. You do. Rest is history, as they say.
Just bringing the two together of Man City and Brighton, I've looked at the game state and the share of time in each game state. Man City just 9% of the time in a losing game state, which is the fewest of anyone in the Premier League. Brighton, 35%. So only Luton, Burnley and Sheffield United have spent more time in a losing game state. So it speaks to making substitutions maybe out of necessity as much as anything.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, guys, for putting so much thought into things like how to chase a game and what to do with your allotted substitutions. It's been great fun this week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. So shout out Gavin B for the idea. Thanks also to Prasanna and Caleb for their suggestions. On the Athletic app, there is a specific page for this podcast and for each episode as well. You can comment on what we've spoken about today and suggest future topics. To do so, you'll need to be a subscriber of The Athletic. So join today. Theathletic.com/tactics is where you should go to get a discount on your annual subscription. And do join us, please, next week of all weeks as we wave goodbye to 2023 for the last pod of the year. Thanks for listening. Go well.
The Athletic.